This is the State of Things broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. North Carolina can no longer be considered a fully functioning democracy, according to a new report from the Electoral Integrity Project, which is hosted by Harvard University and the University of Sydney. It scores the state on a range of indicators, including voter registration and voter district boundaries, and concludes that North Carolina's overall score ranks it alongside pseudo-democracies and authoritarian states. One of the project's co-founders discussed the report in a recent op-ed published in the News and Observer, and the findings apparently struck a nerve. The piece went viral. It elicited comments from around the world, including a growing stream of targeted vitriolic threats and abuse. I'm joined in the studio today by the author of the op-ed, Andrew Reynolds. He's a political science professor at UNC who specializes in democratic design. He has consulted on election and constitutional design in countries including Afghanistan, Iraq, Kenya, and Syria, among others. Andy, welcome back to the State of Things.
Thank you.
Take us back to the beginning. Give us a bit of the story on the Electoral Integrity Project and kind of what is the aim of this project overall.
So I'd been working in the field of election design in other parts of the world for about a decade in the early 2000s. And a colleague of mine who's Danish, and I felt that there wasn't a very good method of really assessing the quality of the elections. A lot of the impressions we saw were sort of very thumb-sucking, it's good, it's bad. And that left a lot of room for politicizing the claim about how good an election was. So we developed a sort of metric of looking at all the stages of an election from the framework all the way through to the vote counting and then the releasing of the results. A pretty academic framework that you would score both on the basis of evaluations but also on quantitative evidence. And then in 2012, that was adopted into this larger project, the Electoral Integrity Project, which, as you said, is based at Harvard and at Sydney. And they had the capacity then to take this methodology, test it out, and just look at how elections were performing both as a whole, but also the different discrete factors. You could say, well, we're doing well on registration, but not so well on polling day. Or you could say that we as a country are doing well about the framework, but actually the mechanisms for addressing complaints aren't very good. So it was a sort of a health indicator of the vibrancy of the democracy.
And how did it play out? In other words, you said that they began in 2012 to apply this. So how do we know that? What did it find? And how do we know that the framework itself tells us what we're looking for?
So it was actually developed in a number of different places and went through sort of beta testing. Initially, Jørn Elklid and I had taken it to the Australian Election Commission in Canberra, who worked on it, and then Elections Canada in Ottawa, who also worked on it. And then EIP, the Electoral Integrity Project, actually developed it even further, tested it, began to use it in larger scale surveys, and then tweaked it as they felt it needed some tweaking. And I have to say, at the end of the day, I don't think it's perfect, but I think it gives us a good feel for the quality of that moment, which is the election moment. Not the whole democracy, but that part of democracy that are elections. It's giving us a pretty good feel for where a state is, where a country is, and how they compare.
All right. So speaking of states, you talk about how North Carolina rates and ranks among these other places that where it's been used. How did that come about? How did North Carolina get into this mix in the first place?
Well, last year in November, the project had the capacity to look really for the first time in a detailed way at the U.S. And they decided that most of their efforts had been spent on new democracies, post-conflict states. Why not see how the metric worked in an established democracy like America? And they had the biggest, I think, endeavor that they've used before, and they were able to treat each state of the union as a discrete actor within the process and actually give a whole American score, but also then state by state, which allowed us to get a feel for the quality of election performance across the country.
And when it came to North Carolina, tell us about the op-ed in which you say that, in fact, North Carolina ranks very poorly and is right down there among pseudo-democracies and authoritarian states. What do you mean by that?
So I actually felt that there was a question about democracy atrophying in our state, in North Carolina. There was a worry that a lot of things were combining together to make us less of a democracy. And so I wanted to gather some indicators. And one of those indicators was the Electoral Integrity Project score for North Carolina, which was particularly bad on districting and particularly bad on the registration of the entire population and the access to the vote for majorities and minorities. But then I also sort of triangulated that with other indicators, basically looking at what the courts had done. And the courts had said that our districts were unlawful. The Fourth Circuit said that it was unconstitutional. The courts had said that our pernicious targeted surgical removal of African Americans was unconstitutional, was unlawful. And we also had very recent blocks on the what some people have called the power grab in Raleigh from the legislature taking power away from the executive. And so I thought that if you looked at all those indicators, what you saw was Carolina being a pseudo-democracy, a semi-democracy, an imperfect democracy, but a democracy that was heading in the wrong direction, a democracy that actually needed to have the car and turn it around because we were getting to a point where power was no longer entirely dependent on the voters. And the wielding of power was no longer that classic contract between the voters and the representatives. There was too much of a detachment there. And the biggest example of that to me was HB2, because 55% of Tar Heels say that they disapprove of HB2, but it passed through easily in the State House and the State Senate. So this disjuncture was worrying me.
This is a different kind of analysis, though. You said initially that what the EIP is looking at is that moment in the democratic process in which the public participates most directly. But now you're talking about policy questions, HB2, stripping Roy Cooper of power, all of these things that are sort of outside of that framework. Are you comfortable that you have the same kind of quantitative analysis that you bring to the other sections of this analysis?
Well, I mean, it's a debate that we're having. I mean, I would like this debate to be about how North Carolina governance functions better than it is doing today. I don't think anybody can seriously dispute the fact that we have a crisis, a problem in the governance in the state. Whether you're a Republican or a Democrat, we have broken down in our smooth functioning, our civil discourse, and the relationship between the voters and the rulers, in a sense. So I think the thing about the election moment is that it sets up everything else. And the flaws in our election process actually lead us to getting to a position where the state legislature is doing things that the federal state says are unlawful.
Talk about this, though, because actually North Carolina didn't rank lowest in these Democratic indicators. There were other states that did worse than North Carolina, several others. Why focus on North Carolina?
Well, I mean, partly because it's my state, but also I think that Carolina is interesting in that it's emblematic of many of the challenges that face American politics today. It is not unique, but Carolina's atrophying democracy, Carolina's breakdown in political discourse, Carolina's position at the battlefront of civil rights historically, both in race and ethnicity and now in LGBT politics, makes Carolina a very interesting demonstrative case about what happens and how things can be improved and changed. And so I was not saying that Carolina was the worst state for elections in the union. That's clearly not true. And that's sort of not relevant to the argument. The argument is that in North Carolina, we have a series of self-reinforcing challenges to our democracy. And I would like us to be self-aware of that. And I would like us to actually begin to have a public discussion about how we address that. It's not a partisan issue. And indeed, a lot of these challenges have been driven by the culpability of Democrats and Republicans in the past. But ultimately, it's not really a discussion we're having because everything has become so partisan.
and emotional. This quickly went viral, and you got a range of response, much of it vitriolic and hateful. Tell us about the response you got.
Well, I think, I mean, stepping back as a sort of a sociologist, a political scientist, and watching this, it's been fascinating because the response was huge and it was very emotional. And initially, it was overwhelmingly positive. I'd say the first 2-3 days, I was receiving hundreds of emails and comments that were very positive and about 20% negative. And then 4-5 days into the viral outbreak, it switched over to being much more negative than positive and much more abusive and threatening around a couple of significant trends. One trend was racist and lots of attacks upon me being either Muslim or sympathetic to Muslims, and then homophobic and transphobic, so lots of attacks upon me being gay or transgender or wanting to abuse women in bathrooms dressed as a woman.
These are accusations that these critics were making.
Right, right.
Yes.
And so all of the complaints about the analysis of democracy are linked up with other cultural fault lines in society. And that to me has been fascinating. And it is true that there was a huge peak and it very quickly died down. And now there's a sort of residue.
Well, there was at least one academic critique. Columbia University professor Andrew Gelman wrote a piece that criticized the methodology, pointing to the fact that, you know, for instance, North Carolina does worse than North Korea. And how can this possibly be? And kind of at the end of his piece, he talked about this just not being good common sense.
Well, I think that was something of a red herring. And it was unfortunate that, as Professor Gelman said in the first paragraph of his piece, he hadn't looked at the data itself. He also went on to say that he knew nothing about the politics of North Carolina. And then his critique was based on North Korea, which, while alphabetically is next to North Carolina, it sort of has nothing else in common. Unfortunately, there was a discussion about a methodology that had been dropped, and North Korea had been dropped by the project years ago, and it wasn't really focusing on the issue of Carolina. I mean, I would love to have a discussion about how strong Carolina's institutions are, how satisfied voters feel with their state house and their representatives. I don't want to talk about North Korea. I don't really care whether North Korea is ranked as a state that is functioning or not. Clearly, North Korea is a repressive regime and looks nothing like North Carolina. But let's have that discussion about Carolina and where we're going.
You talked about much of the criticism that you received falling along cultural fault lines because most of the critiques focused on those ideas rather than the idea of democracy. Can you have this discussion that we're talking about? The democracy is an abstract idea, and if my side is winning, I don't really care how we got there. I mean, do we? This is my question to you as a political scientist. Do people really care about democracy, or they just want to win?
Well, I think my experience in the rest of the world, and I began looking at these issues in South Africa, was that you can get a large section of society that is not necessarily altruistic, but looks at the long game. The long game is not in 2 or 4 years' time. The long game is in 20 or 30 years' time. And you need to think about how the state functions above and beyond your party's capacity to win on any given day. And I found it interesting that there are a couple of Republican state house members who, very to their credit, have said they believe in nonpartisan districting because they are North Carolinians first and Republicans second. And I think that that would benefit a lot of the political actors in this state to think about not their ability to win in November, but their ability to have a productive, happy, healthful state in the longer period.
As you said, you've been involved in democracy building and election reform in post-conflict states. What happens when they take a look at our process? And you talked about redistricting as one example. How many of those states who are now building themselves out of the ashes want to replicate precisely what we do here?
Well, Well, I think it's interesting that I've never been in a country that has politicians drawing the district lines for elections. And every country that I've been in has been aghast at the fact that we allow the foxes to be in charge of the hen house, and it seems illogical on the face of it. So there are some things that I think new democracies look to America and replicate because they see it working. There are some things within our political institutions they look at in the United States and say we do not want to replicate that because it is not a way of producing democratic outcomes in our state. Interestingly, I was in Pakistan, who have serious democratic problems, but they were aghast that we allowed the politicians to draw the district lines.
Tell us more about these threats and your personal safety. I mean, some of these attacks and threats have been brutal, and I wonder how seriously you're taking them. And I know that you've had conversations with the chancellor concerning your own safety.
Well, I have to say that, you know, I may be a little bit not blasé, but having spent time in Afghanistan and Libya and Egypt and Sudan and lots of places that are troubled, I suppose my brain is a little bit more set up to perhaps ignore some of these threats. But I have to say my campus police, who have been very, very good after reviewing phone messages and emails, were more concerned about my personal safety than I was. And the university system has, to its credit, been incredibly supportive, not just of my personal position, but also of the discussion this has begun and my ability to bring my expertise to the service of the state of North Carolina. And that's the interesting thing about the UNC system, is that we have a mandate to bring our expertise to help the people of North Carolina, whether we study medicine or environmental science or building bridges. And I feel as though democracy is another area of expertise we can offer to the people to begin that discussion.
Yeah, and in terms of the way the discussion goes forward, again, in this era of social media, things rise and fall very quickly. You have now some data that you can collect just based on your response. And you told me before the program started that you're planning to use that in your research.
Well, I do think that there's an interesting forensic anatomy of a viral moment in time. You know, political scientists rarely get read more than three people on a given day, and two of those are your family members. So now I have some nice data of responses from around the world from, you know, thousands of people that I can actually categorize and see what happened, how quickly it dissipated, and what people said. So I am going to put together a piece for the Washington Post on the anatomy of a viral moment, which I think informs some of us about our capacity to be engaged in these discussions as engaged scholars, and not just being in the ivory tower, but actually speaking there in the dirty business of politics and how that happens in reality.
Finally, do you see any relationship between a viral moment and the kind of sustained conversation that you're talking about, or does the viral moment, in fact, sap some of the energy for a more robust conversation?
That's a very good question. I would hope that our discussions about improving democracy in Carolina continue on in a civil and inclusive way. I don't know what's going to happen because we're leading up to another election process, but I hope that there is a degree of bipartisan discussion, at least, around these questions. And my biggest fear is that that marketplace of ideas, that public town square discussion, has almost declined to being non-existent in North Carolina, that we don't meet and talk to people who don't look like us or think like us anymore. And I know this has been a common refrain, but I would love that discussion to be broadened and grow over the next year.
Andy, always a pleasure. Thank you so much for talking with us.
My pleasure.
Andrew Reynolds is a professor of political science at UNC Chapel Hill, and you can find links to his research and his op-eds and more information about the Electoral Integrity Project at our website, stateofthings.org. Just ahead, how to engage more people in science. You'll hear that on The State of Things from North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. Stay tuned.